You are listening to Something Rather Than Nothing. Creator and host, Ken Vellante. Editor and producer, Peter Bauer.
Just generally right now, you doing okay now? Everything all right?
Strangely, yes. You know, like, because of the way India is so overpopulated and under infrastructured and so forth, it usually takes the brunt of all of these pandemics in one way or another. But we've been incredibly lucky with this one. So fingers crossed at the moment. You know, it's possible that they can undo, if for example, if they open the trains too early, they could undo a lot of the good work that's been done. So fingers crossed, people will be smart about letting it go for another few months.
Yeah. Well, that's certainly good to hear. And it was, and you mentioned too about the, I knew just in general about that dynamic that can impact India as a country. And of course, you've lived there. How long you lived there now, Michael?
Just 6 months shy of 10 years.
6 months shy of 10 years. And you are in Mumbai specifically?
I have one apartment in Pune, Maharashtra, and one in Mumbai. They're about 2.5 hours away from each other. So I spend the weekends in Bombay where I have two businesses, and then I teach on the weekdays in Pune.
And so everybody, I should mention that this is Ken Vellante with Something Rather Than Nothing podcast. We are talking with Michael Burns, who is a friend of mine and somebody I studied with at the University of Massachusetts and a labor studies activist program. A great man and great artist. And part of this is catching up with Michael, who's done some documentary film. He did one on EMDR therapy. And he has a lot of writing. He's been on TED Talk. You see videos of him that way. And also well known, made a name for himself in a very very popular Tall Tales, right, Michael? Can you tell us a bit about Tall Tales and just how you got started in India, putting that together and talking about storytelling?
Yeah, sure. I'll try to sum it up in a few minutes. Well, you know, about 6 years ago now, I was just trying to find something to do with my time. You know, I came to India with my ex who was doing work here. So when that happens to you, the other partner is kind of trying to find things to do with their time. And I was starting to get into a few ideas with writing, but I said to myself, you know, I've always been a big fan of The Moth. You know, what if I did one night of storytelling here in Bombay? And I put together one night, and it was a lot of fun. And, you know, people told true stories, you know, true personal stories. And then we said, hey, that was so much fun. Let's do another one. And 6 years later, the next show will be our 77th show. And in addition to that, you know, we get about 20 stories per month for people that want to tell stories at our live show. And we only select 4 or 5 of them. So what happened was those other 15 were saying, okay, what's wrong with my story? How can I get some advice? And you probably know this from any work that you've done, Ken. Giving people concrete advice about how they can improve their work is something really time consuming. So so about 5 years ago, I said, hey, I have an idea. Why don't I put together a little workshop where I can talk about some of the ins and outs of quality writing and quality storytelling so that the people who got turned away for one reason or another can improve their stories. And that was, again, just a one-off thing, but my next workshop will be somewhere around my 250th workshop, and now I'm doing work in different countries. And this small little thing has now grown into the most popular creative writing workshop in South Asia. So it's ballooned to this giant thing, and I've learned so much along the way. So it's Tall Tales. We do these live shows. We do the public workshops, and we also do private consultations and trainings for companies and organizations.
That's it's really exciting to hear, and it's very I can just hear in your voice, you know, the excitement around it. And I've listened to some of your stuff and some of the things you've had to say about it. And yeah, there is a very compelling component about how you talk about the process, but also just, you know, the bravery that we have to try to find as humans to, you know, go up there and, you know, there's so many questions that buzz in our head, but just to kind of tell a story, you know, what happened and try to get that down. Yeah.
You hit right on it with this idea of bravery and courage. You know, the supreme problem right now in the world of storytelling is the overuse of the word story. You know, everything is a story. You know, Instagram says your breakfast is a story. You know, it's like it's almost to the point where any pile of words on a piece of paper is a story. Right. And the problem with that, that's a very nice sounding thing. And I hate to kind of pick on something that has a nice ring to it. But the problem with that is if you want to be better at storytelling and yet everything is a story, you will never be able to fine tune those details because you've taken this very all-encompassing approach. And actually, you know, a poem doesn't want to be a story. Sometimes a photo just is a photo, right? Sometimes a cigar is just a cigar. Sometimes a story is a story. And I think that one of the reasons my workshop has resonated with people is I tell them, like, let's not take this kumbaya version of what a story is. Let's talk about what a story is like we're building a bridge. And it's a bridge is not the same thing as a sphere. A bridge is not the same thing as a car. Let's build the bridge together. And once you learn that, you're free to build any bridge, any size, any color, any shape, any function that you possibly want to. And I think people like that. They actually like zooming in on the art of what a story really is and what a story isn't. So in my workshop, I spend a lot of time talking about what a story isn't. And believe it or not, people like that.
Oh yeah. Well, and I can definitely see it's like guiding that. Let's one question I want to ask you and, kind of zooming back a little bit is, sure. And I ask a lot of the creators, that come onto the show, did you always, were you always a storyteller? Did you learn it? I mean, what were you like as a young, as a young Michael, younger child? And, as far as, areas around creativity or what interests you, stories, anything like that?
You know, I had a strange upbringing in terms of where I ended up. But, you know, like you don't have another life that you live simultaneously side by side to compare it to, you know, so it's kind of strange. Like I would never have it any other way, but I certainly see things that could have been different. But one of the reasons I love the kind of strange path that I took is that I was never encouraged to read when I was young. I don't even really remember finishing a book until I might have been 13 or 14 or something like that. I was raised on TV like a lot of American suburban kids. And I was always good at school, but it was just pure luck, you know, no studying, that type of thing. Bored with high school, but very good grades, you know, because I guess I was just bright enough to be able to do the subjects that were being taught competently. But the reason why I appreciated that is because when I got into university, when I started in college, I felt like I was born. You know, I always joke with friends that when you turn 18, you should take on a new name. You know, you should get a new name because in some ways you have a new identity as an adult. And that fits me perfectly because as soon as I entered university, it was a new person that was born, somebody who was curious about the world, somebody who suddenly found themselves loving reading and just soaking in every experience around me. So university became this hypersensitive time for me, whereas maybe for another young person, university might have been just an extension of their high school experience. And so for me, I found a home in academics and went on for a master's as you and I studied together, and then a PhD later on. And it was a very late homecoming in the sense of an academic home, but I'm glad I found it, and I found it with more passion. There's something called the enthusiasm of the late learner, somebody who comes to a field later in life, and I found that, you know.
Yeah, and I definitely share some of your experience and the energy around the impact of the university, or whether it's a university or new ideas, or as you get to adulthood, and just being like, you know, intensely curious, you know, about things and what about this? And I remember, you know, with you, just a lot, you know, like history and you know, other type of, you know, interest in ways you developed. And, you know, I definitely identify with a lot of that. So now if we look at, you know, I've alluded to, you know, some of the things that, you know, that you've done to start the podcast, you know, your current, you know, teaching, the role of a teacher, you know, storytelling yourself. I know you've done, comedy, and you've done a documentary film on EMDR. You have an interest in psychology. And this podcast is about creators. So what is, for you, what parts of art or creativity attract you? Is that constantly changing?
Let's see. You know, it's hard to pinpoint, because, you know, I heard this thing, you know, you hear these things and they just stick in your brain. You know, I heard one time that, you know, somebody is supposed to have three careers in their life, you know, and the first time you hear that, you're thinking, well, what is that all about? And the more you think about it, the more you realize that a fulfilling life is actually full of multiple interests, multiple passions, you know. And I made five documentaries for American and international television. And then I reached a point where I felt finished with that, like not in a sense that I had conquered the field or anything, but I was just ready to move on to another aspect of another dimension of my personality. And ironically, my PhD dissertation was on the kind of psychological pitfalls of storytelling, the types of stories you can tell that lead to a worse society or that lead to a destructive psyche. And strangely, I mean, incredibly, who would have thought that somebody who wrote that dissertation is now giving workshops on storytelling? But the reason I think that that's helpful is because I don't look at storytelling as this panacea. I look at it as something that's useful for some things and not useful for other things. So my pursuit of art is just a reflection of the different curiosities that I have. And I don't know about you, Ken, but the more I get older, the more I realize that curiosity is probably the most important thing that I want to nurture in myself and the most attractive thing that I find in other people too.
I would completely agree with what you just said. And I also, you know, think it can challenge a lot of us when those energies come up. And, you know, it's not necessarily to stay on one of those tracks, or if you have an artistic mind bent, or you like to create, or you're, you know, a seeker in some sort of sense, you know, you're not going to get at the end point. You're kind of going to keep moving and developing, right? So, given that, just chatting a little bit about art and, you know, kind of ways of creativity, for you, do you have a definition of art? You know, what is art?
You know, I like to, you know, some people don't like to define the undefinable, but I like it because we also recognize that no answer is final. But I always thought that art is something that communicates to somebody. So if there's a communicative experience going on here, then I think we have entered into art. I mean, when if you go to a modern art museum with somebody who hates modern art, you can see this in Technicolor. Because they'll say this is nothing, like this is just a red canvas, and it's all kind of a capitalist game just to see how much money you can make off. There's rich people doing bartering with having too much money and so forth. But if it says something to me, then it's art enough for me. So when something is entirely subjective like that, you just have to ask yourself whether there is a message for you or a reflection for you or a question for you. And if there is, it's art, no matter how vehemently somebody else tells you it's garbage or a waste of time, you know?
Yeah. And, in art has that component. I think when you were talking about storytelling in your thesis, and I'm sure people, you know, start asking you additional questions about your thesis anytime you're talking. I just want to make sure I don't miss that. I found it very evocative that you're saying, you know, you're in the business of storytelling, and a lot of times when we talk about processes or activities, you know, they tend to be like, well, that's a good thing to do. When you said that there are some stories that don't quite work that way, that are harmful and things like that, I immediately jumped to politics, but I don't want to assume what you're saying with that. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, there's a political dimension, there's social dimension, and of course it all dovetails into the individual psychological dimension. So I was lucky enough to be the first student in the history of the UK to do an audiovisual dissertation. So I did a three-part documentary in six different countries looking at young people's perceptions of democracy at the same time as writing 300,000 words for my dissertation. And one of the things that I was focusing on is the way that young people think about politics, the way they think about stories, the way they think about the stories that kind of animate their country's histories. And what I found so fascinating is that that even though, again, we have this really beautiful idea of that every moment is a story, that storytelling has a very dark underside. And you mentioned politically. So a story, people often ask me, you know, a reporter will often ask me, what is a story? Can you give it in a brief sentence? And I don't like to do that because I think a story is building a bridge. So you have to talk about the whole process, but you come up with certain answers. And I think if I had to boil it down to something, a story is about, is an attempt to solve a problem. So a story is an attempt to solve a problem. So politically, if you position your propaganda, you could say, ideology, however you want to say it, as leader X will solve that problem for you. Let's, for example, North Korea, you know, leader X will always be able to solve problem Y for you. You have a type of storytelling that has a very dark, nefarious underside to it. It is solving a problem, but the answer they provide is shoved down your throat rather than proposed to you as a question. The lighter side of that, I would say it's equally as dark, but it has a laugh track to it, is the sitcom. You know, in the sitcom, we have a problem and we have a resolution, but the truth is that life's problems are far more complicated than 22 minutes can solve. And I think what it does is it primes the brain to think of problems as things that are easy to conquer. And to think of our life challenges as things that will be very, very temporary. But in fact, they might, existential crises and other problems might last your whole life. So we live in a world where storytelling tells us that everything is a happy ending. But very often the endings are absurd and tragic, as we're seeing right now.
Yeah. And I think when you're saying that right there, I didn't quite look at the kind of time frame of how you tell the story and that there is resolution. And, you know, just thinking about the idea of, you know, what type of behaviors or what type of things we mimic or what our expectations are.
Yeah,
you know,
that's it.
Like,
yeah.
I got this nagging problem and it's still nagging me. That doesn't seem right, you know.
Right. So then people, when that happens, people ask, well, what's wrong with me? You know, everybody, I look at all these smiling faces on social media. I watch all these shows where everything is tied up at the end. Well, my life, the problems persist. What's wrong with me? And then depression and then so forth. But actually, that's the normal state of reality, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So have you ever stepped back? You help people create and you create yourself. Do you ever step back and say, why do I create or why am I creating this?
You know, there's if you step back far enough and you start to look at these big questions, which kind of you're hinting at a little bit, which is, you know, why are we here and so forth? You know, there are no good answers, and there are no good there's no solid ground to stand on, because as we know, you know, this whole thing might be a projection. This whole thing might be some kind of strange experiment, you know. But one thing that seems true for me, one thing that seems to resonate as real as anything can be, is unnecessary suffering in the world. So I see my job, I see the job of all of us, is doing as much as we can to mitigate unnecessary suffering. And my work has been centered on social justice issues. My first major film about the Bush administration. I did a film also about the third party politics and getting more voices into politics. And then I did this one about EMDR and psychological catharsis. But my other work also is about recognizing the parts of our own lives where we are suffering with unresolved trauma and facing that, you know, Plato's Apology, line 38A, you know, the unexamined life is not worth living. You know, I take that to heart, and I believe that it's our job to look at where we're suffering ourselves. And once we free ourselves from that, we can start to look at the suffering of others. And to me, that's as real as anything. And that's as unifying of a human mission as anything I can think of.
Yeah, and I think you gave me a tiny bit of license by mentioning Plato. I do have to say, when in your like I said, I was very intrigued about the concept, the sitcom, or that timing component. And I really did move back to think about thinking about Plato and Plato's philosophy, and kind of like some of his comments about art in the Republic and about poetry. But that it's kind of like this repetition of almost like a false story or an artificial story that kind of stultifies the mind. And, you know, as a writer, and Plato being a brilliant philosopher, it was always kind of troublesome, because he had such, you know, harsh words for poets and others. In his theory of art was like extremely vexing and difficult. But there seemed to be something there about, in my opinion, that kind of anticipated a more modern media, or the role that stories that aren't positioned well or aren't aimed in the right direction can give some negative results.
Yeah,
I felt some of that in your answer. And I know you've done a decent amount of Plato, if I recall correctly.
I'm interested in everything, you know.
So another thing I wanted to capture is, and just to make sure I have it, as far as how you help folks with storytelling, is this going up on a stage and telling my story that way? Is it me, you know, getting it down and writing and telling the story that way, or people do both, or how do you specifically help people do that?
Yeah, so the live storytelling is just for fun. I mean, like, even, you know, it's even when it's bad, it's still good. You know, I mean, it's still fun to get up there and tell your story. So, you know, like, sometimes it's hit or miss, but it's fun nevertheless. But most of my work right now is involved in writing coaching. So people will bring a manuscript to me, or some idea about what they want to write, for either fiction or nonfiction, and I will help them to shape it. As I said to you before we started recording, there is so much terrible advice out there about writing, including you're either born with it or not, you know, or this idea that the whole idea is going to come to you in one shot or something like this. There's so many totally insane ideas that reject writing as a craft, something that you can improve at, something that you can be better at. And in a weird way, that's good for me, because I think I'm providing a little bit of hard knocks, you know, not a lot of hand holding in terms of how to build a bridge and how not to build a bridge. And people like that. And so they bring me their puzzle pieces, and I help them to find out what a story is. We learn that together. And then once we learn that, to start to put the pieces of what they have together and recognize what's missing. And it's so much fun to see a novel like totally click for somebody once they recognize how the bridge is held up, you know, how the suspension actually works with the other pieces and so forth. So it's an incredible feeling to help somebody make their dreams come true. And so, yes, we do that on stage also, but the really fulfilling work is with books. You know, you might know this, but 84% of the population wants to write a book someday. But that number, I would argue, is a lot higher than the people who are taking time to learn how to do that. And so my role is to help them to fulfill that dream, you know?
Yeah, I really love that and what you had to say there. I had a question. I was thinking about, you know, you mentioned a little bit earlier that you've been in India for about a decade, and you know, you've created there and worked there, and you mentioned before that you know, you'd done documentaries stateside and done work in that capacity. When you're going into creating something or trying to navigate two different countries, right? So particularly United States and India, I mean, were you able to identify stark differences as far as what you were trying to do and what type of space there was for you to be creative in each country?
Yes and no. You know, both of these countries are big enough that you can carve out, as you know, like there are some incredible pockets of society in the U.S. Where art is appreciated, where conversation and disagreement is celebrated and so forth. And then there's the vast majority of the place. The same thing is true here. You know, democracy is very much under attack in India in terms of a free press, in terms of quality elections and a whole bunch of other issues, including human rights, workers' rights, gender equality. We can go right down the list. In some aspects, we're still in the Stone Age here. In the U.S., we almost have this kind of dystopian postmodern version of it where people are willfully ignorant. Whereas here, you know, they're desperate to learn. In the U.S., the willful rejection of the hand in front of your face has terrified me so much, Ken, and I'm so glad that I'm so glad there are people like you who are willing to stick it out, but I just had to get out of there. I literally couldn't take it anymore. And I spent some time in Europe and I loved that. And I spent some time in India and I love it and hate it here too. But, the U.S. is a place that's hard for me to spend a lot of time right now because of what's happening to the culture.
Yeah, understood. And I mean, not to sit here and, you know, read everything into it, but you mentioned some aspects of the sensitivity to, you know, what's going on. And I think there's always this frustrating component within the United States of this, you know, fervent anti-intellectualism. And it's just so vitriolic. And if you combine that with a curious personality, you know, there's plenty of people curious about a lot of different things and want to explore a lot of different things. And, you know, if that's not valued, you kind of feel, well, okay, I feel like I'm going against the grain all the time, or I am going against the grain all the time.
You want to, I'll tell you a little funny anecdote that I think about all the time. I think about this way too much. So one of my good friends I did my PhD with, Maria, we were chatting a few years ago online, and she said, I just came back from a trip. And she was kind of irritated about something. I said, oh, did something happen? And she said, yeah, you know, I was sitting next to this guy on the plane, this old British guy. And you know how you sit next to people on the plane and they start talking? So I said, yeah, okay. And she said, and he asked me, you know, I asked him what he did and he told me, and he asked me what I did. And Maria said, I told him I teach American culture at Nottingham University in the UK. And then she wrote to me, she said, can you believe what he asked me next? He asked me, is there such a thing as American culture? You know, and then she was like, I was so offended. I just turned my head and I didn't look at him for the rest of the plane ride. And I said something I probably shouldn't have said, but I wrote to him. I said, I'm not sure he's wrong. You know, I'm not sure what it is, because I know culture has something to do with history. If I had to pinpoint it, I would say American culture is buying junk with money you don't have. Or we can go back to conquering the wilderness and barbarism. I don't know. I really just don't know what it is. So one of the reasons I see myself as a citizen of the world rather than a permanent resident of the U.S. is I feel like, unlike Europe and unlike some other civilizations, we're so new that there is no identity formed. And the formation that's happening is too terrifying to watch up close.
Well, let me try. I mean, you've really prompted my thinking. I'm going to try to sum up the U.S. and some of the questions we ask too here. You know, I'm asking, what is art, right? So I love, you know, I started painting 2-3 years ago, love art, love painting, find out new things about myself, like what I create, all those type of things. And the headline today was that the White House was going ahead with an approval to paint the entire wall between the United States and Mexico with black paint to the tune of $500 million. Okay. And I put my phone down. I would have folded my paper down a few years ago and said, well, that's it right there, isn't it? A half billion, not only, you know, the wall's the wall, right? To make sure it's painted black for $500 million and saying, right, we are unhinged from things I can understand. But thank you for helping me with that a bit.
No, the willingness to sacrifice, because when we're talking about money, we're talking about sacrificing people's lives, of course, you know, so yes. Like the willingness to put people's lives in jeopardy for the sake of some death worshiping cult ideology is so profound in our country that the only way you can survive is by putting it out of your mind. Otherwise, you would just throw up constantly, you know?
Well, I don't know if this questioning is going to lead in, you know, or color the particular question, which is the big one, Michael. I was wondering if you knew why there's something rather than nothing.
I don't know whether there is something rather than nothing. But I do think that that when somebody is healed, it is a moment that you share. So in all the work that I do, whether it's trying to educate people through my films, my writing, or in the catharsis that I think I bring out through my storytelling work, it's all about healing wounds. So healing them as a country, as a policy, or as an individual. And that moment, if it is an illusion, if it is nothing, if it has no resonance beyond its surface appearance, then it is the greatest illusion ever created, because those moments have ripple effects. Those moments can change your life. They can change the lives of the people who witness them. So in storytelling, when I see that, I'm touched by it in a way that makes me guess that there is something rather than nothing.
All right. Thank you for that, Michael. Now I know we haven't seen each other in quite some time, 20 years. Now I know why I miss you. That's just lovely. And one of the things I was forgot to mention at the beginning, I remembered that we had at the University of Massachusetts, we had collaborated together on the living wage study for Boston, Massachusetts.
Right.
And we worked on that research project for a while. I remember we were annoying a lot of people with a lot of information requests.
But you know, like having beat up on the U.S. for a little while in the past few minutes, you know, let's just talk about the flip side for a second, because as we're seeing with the living wage 20 years ago, and as we're seeing with Bernie Sanders' campaign and other things, is that ideas that were once thought to be absurd or impossible are now becoming self-evident.
Amen.
And this is fantastic. This is the great thing about America. So there are many tragic things, but the best thing about the American experiment is its willingness to relook at any idea and redo it if it needs redoing. You know, so in Europe you have the tradition for tradition's sake type of thing. In the Far East where I am, you have more of an autocratic way. So and so says to do it that way, we're going to do it that way. But in America, there's a spirit of entrepreneurship and experimentation that is incredibly attractive and important. And I love the fact that we were involved in something that made a difference eventually. And I think that instead, because of the weird times that we're in now, instead of thinking about watching our trees come to fruition, we should be thinking about planting seeds that somebody else is going to nurture in the future.
I really appreciate that, brother. I want to have folks who are listening to podcasts to be able to connect with you and the work that you do as well. So can you just kind of lay out just kind of ways to access, the work that you do or point out creations or things that you're working on, whether it's online or just so folks can link up with the work that you do?
Yeah, of course. So my newest thing is I'm launching 4 new online writing classes. So I've teach almost exclusively in the US, India, and I just did a workshop in the Middle East. But now I'm doing, starting June 1st, starting this summer, I'll be doing some online writing classes worldwide. So that's Tall Tales, TALLTALES.podia.com. So Podia is a great platform for teaching online classes. So that's my newest venture. TallTales.in, TALLTALES.in is the website for my company. I also do this. I have this small company that does non-electronic educational toys for kids. You know, sadly, everybody's just staring at their phones all day here. So I have a company called KahaniCubes.com, which means story cubes in Hindi. And we're kind of trying to bring back non-electronic ways to spend your time with friends and family. And then I have my website, michaelpburns.com, where you can find out more about my film work, my political leanings, my interests, as well as my new focus, which is the art of storytelling and the importance of telling stories that have never been told before.
Thank you so much, Michael. I'm definitely going to deliberately connect with you on the writing workshop, and I know it's just the time's right for me. And I know there's been a couple, over the years, you and I have kind of sent a message here, there, back and forth, and the same type of things, resonate for me. I think what you had to say about, the on the something rather than nothing question about, the healing and the catharsis and the very, very deep, powerful human transformation that you can help folks with, with the storytelling and with being able to write or, attempt to understand our experiences, really some profound stuff. And also wanted to thank you for taking the time to join the podcast from India. It's been an absolute great pleasure to connect with you, Michael. And I very much look forward to working with you in that writing process and tap into some of the things that seem available within me. So I want to thank you for that.
Thanks so much, Ken. Really nice talking to you. Always good to talk with an open-minded person.
Take care, brother, and thanks again.
Bye-bye.
Bye now.
You are listening to Something Rather Than Nothing.